planetaudio.org.nz. planetaudio.org.nz.
Tuvalu Language Week this week. Vaiaso te ngana Tuvalu. And the theme for this year is, excuse me if I don't pronounce it properly, La ke mo te manuia ataiao, which means striving for a prosperous future. And I'm so blessed today to have in the studio here with me, Metua Bates. She has been a huge influence for me in just working in Pacific Health. She has helped me a lot with my line of work, and also as a member of the Pacific Health and Welfare Group. So I'll just read out a little brief of our guest here. Okay. Miss Metua is a passionate and highly experienced leader and senior manager with an extensive background leading key research, health and community initiatives to support nationwide policy objectives and goals. Capable of creating mutually beneficial partnerships and relationships with multiple external agencies, with the ability to work at all levels of the organization, from executive management through to frontline staff. Oh, that's so paramount. And I know Metua, she is the person to the link in terms of making various organizations move forward. Metua is committed to the support and development of Pacific peoples, and she was also awarded the Queen's Service Medal for contributions to the Cook Islands community. Matua currently is manager of Pacific Integration and Development Services at Alliance Health Plus, and she will be sharing with us what they do at Alliance Health Plus and the work she currently does there. Being a registered nurse with an executive MBA qualification and Queen Service Medal awarded for her contributions to the Cook Islands community, Matua has significant experience in leading and managing programs designed to improve the health and well-being of Pacific peoples. You know, in my eyes, Matua is one of the few who has worked and served at the front line as a registered nurse for years, and also has many, many years' experience running and sitting at the executive management level where those tough decisions are made that affect our Pacific health and welfare outcomes. So she has proven experience, realistic and valuable experience, perspectives of how it really is for us Pacific peoples and our communities. A balanced view perspective. As Matua said, quote unquote, "I'm excited to have been appointed as the PIDS manager and look forward to contributing to the Alliance Health Plus mission of transforming the health and well-being of Pacific and high needs communities." Matua says about her new role. Matua was formerly the vice president of the Auckland branch of Pacifica Inc. and their national treasurer. She has more than, almost older than me, more than 35 years experience in the health sector and has worked extensively within the Pacific community in New Zealand to promote positive health outcomes as a foundation member of the Cook Islands Nurses Association. And in 2002, she was the recipient of the Pacific Health Leadership Award. Matua is an inspirational leader not only amongst her beloved Cook Island and Tahitian people, but also a leader of our Pacific people in New Zealand, Aotearoa, and in the Pacific, with the various roles she has held throughout her career as a nurse and management positions within the health sector. Matua also enjoys mentoring and coaching keen students of all ages to achieve their educational aspirations, taking all that they are to enhance that experience and passing on the valuable knowledge and experience she has learned over the years. Yes, she has been and continues to be a mentor and an inspiration to me personally. You know, with me starting out in mental health promotion and starting out on air as well with Matua, you know, being a member of Pacific Health and Welfare, PHW. But most importantly, as Matua shared in the PMA, Pacifica Medical Association issue online, here's what she said. "I am not defined by the qualifications I have accumulated, the positions I've held, the material resources I've accumulated, but by who I am and choose to be at any given moment. To stand in the greatness of who I am, child of God, daughter of Dana and Martha Bates, sister to my brother, sisters, cousins, niece to my aunties, uncles, and extended Kōpū tangata, mother to Christopher and Marilyn, mother-in-law to Christina, grandmother to Auntie
D'Artagnan,
yeah, and
Aramis,
Dante, and Anna Lange Gabriella, yeah. Friend, colleague, and acquaintance to many, enables me to make the difference I know I am making in the world." Kia ora, Matua, and thank you again for being here with me. How are you?
Kia ora, Ana Milimili. Thank you so much for the invitation to be here. And after that auspicious introduction, I'm in tears and thinking, who are you talking about? You know, we get people to write these things about us because we're not very good at writing about ourselves. And so just hearing that, it kind of tears me up a little bit. But at the same time, you know, as you finished off,
yes.
I did write those words some years ago, yes. To stand in the greatness of who we are and to not be embarrassed about hearing those words about ourselves is really important. It's not about arrogance or showing
Absolutely.
Off. It's about celebrating the talents and the creation that God has made us.
Yes.
And it's celebrating that. It's celebrating a God who not only gives us responsibilities and purpose, but also gives us the resources to be able to achieve what he wants us to achieve. So thank you for the reminder of those words that I said. And it actually is good to be reminded.
Absolutely.
Of what we put out there. Because it's just helped me to again think, yeah, that is my purpose in life. I want everyone to be standing in the greatness of who they are. We are all great, and we shouldn't hide ourselves under a bushel. God didn't make us to be that way. He made us all to shine, each and every one of us.
Absolutely. Thank you, Matua. You know, as I mentioned briefly, you have been a huge inspiration. And even when I did, you know, I worked very briefly for Whakatauto, I call you up from time to time and lean on you for advice and experience. You know, I'm quite passionate about like minds, but I also needed a bit of direction in terms of, you know, doing what we're supposed to do. And with people like yourself that have been there, done that, makes definitely makes you know, it made my job a lot much easier, you know. But Matua, before we go any further, I know there's so much to touch on. You know, you've been quite busy this year in terms of you know, your role at Alliance Health. I know you guys you on behalf of Alliance Health, we're in a plus sponsored the Pacifica Medical Association conference back in New Wear. Beautiful place, eh?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I also bumped into at the back home in Raro, the annual health conference.
Yes.
So good to see, you know. And and but before we get into that, Matua, can you please just share with some of our listeners? I know you're Pacific Health is it's quite a small, you know, a small group in Auckland. But for our listeners overseas, and maybe the younger listeners too, can you please share with us, Matua, just a little bit about yourself, you know, your upbringing and who you are, please?
Sure. I was born Matua Kore Bates on the island of Aitutaki.
Yes.
And then when I was about 4 years old, there were five of us in the family. My parents decided to come to New Zealand. So our dad came first. So this was back in the 60s. I won't give you the exact dates because then you'll be able to work out my exact age. But in the 60s, my dad came over. And then some months later, Mum and I came over with a couple of us and a cousin. We came over by boat. On the Monaroa, and we stayed with my auntie and uncle, Dad's sister, who lived in Parnell at the time. So Parnell wasn't as poshy as it is now, but way back then. But my auntie married my uncle Stan, and they had a couple of homes, and we lived next to each other. Shortly after that, we moved to Ponsonby. And then not long after that, we moved out to Ōtara. Still in the 60s. So we moved out to Ōtara when it was mostly farmland. Yes. It wasn't all the built-up residency and urbanisation that's happened since. And so I went to school at Flatbush Primary School and Bears Intermediate. And then instead of going to Hillary College, I ended up going to ASDA. Yeah, Auckland Seventh Adventist High School.
Yes.
And so that's where I started my schooling.
Nice.
In my final year, I became the head girl. And the head boy was Lyle Galloway. And I wanted to be a doctor, you know.
Yes.
Things didn't work out that way, and I ended up instead nursing and went to the Sydney Adventist Hospital in Warunga in Sydney, New South Wales.
Okay.
And so that was our church hospital, and I trained as a nurse there for 3 years. My original idea of going was to run away from home, and I needed a legitimate reason, and of course nursing was it. But when I got there, I realised how much I missed my family, and I just wanted to come back home. So as soon as I finished my 3 years, I came straight back home and served at the Auckland Adventist Hospital for a couple of years in the operating theatre. So I really loved working in the operating theatre. So after a couple of years at Auckland Adventist, I went to Waikato Hospital.
Yes.
And did a year's operating theatre and recovery room course there. And then once that was over, I came to Middlemore. And I did about 10 years there. During those 10 years in operating theatre, I kept saying to the charge nurse, I want to do more study. And she kept saying, no, we need you, we need you, we need the staff, we need experienced people to be working. But after 10 years, I'd had enough. And so I said, okay, I've got to go. So I ended up doing an advanced diploma in nursing at AIT, it was called back in the day.
Yes,
so
yes.
The current Auckland University of Technology used to be called AIT.
AIT, yeah.
It was over on the North Shore, but I ended up for a year doing an advanced diploma in nursing. And that gave me the courage to get out of operating theatre,
yes.
Which by that time I'd done 13 years of. And I went out of operating theatre into public health with the cervical screening program.
Yes.
So thanks to a bunch of women from Pacifica, Moira Duthit and Doreen Arapai, and Lisa Foliaki and a few others, Laurel Talfuata, I was coached into preparing for an interview to become the regional cervical screening coordinator for Pacific women for the Auckland Area Health Board. And I'm like, oh, how do I do this? You know, and for me, I just started playing around, and the women were really brutal with me. They said, hey, stop playing around. You know, we've set aside time to coach you, so be serious. And they started talking to me about all the things that I didn't realize I have. There's the qualifications, but there's also, you know, your upbringing in church. So in church, I was the youth leader, the music leader, the
yes.
Pathfinder leader. I had all these responsibilities in church, which I really didn't pay much heed to. But they made me realize that all of that was critical in the leadership roles that I would have in health. So even though I hadn't had formal, you know, titles and positions, my leadership roles in the community, in my church, was critical in being able to engage and mobilise Pacific communities. And so in my interview, I spoke to those things and really, you know, was confronted with who I am in totality, not just the qualifications that I had.
Yes.
And so I won that interview only with the help of those women. So I did that for a couple of years, and then after that we had the health reforms, and the Northern Regional Health Authority came into being, and they said to me, apply for a role. There were two roles.
Yes.
A Pacific role as a Pacific manager, and then a mainstream role as the locality project manager for South Auckland. So there were four locality manager positions.
Okay.
I lived in South Auckland, so it made sense for me to apply.
Mm.
I never thought I'd get that job because I thought I was good for Pacific. You know, after being in mainstream roles for 13 years,
yes.
I thought all I knew now was Pacific, being really brand new into it. So what happened at the end of that shocked me. I didn't get the Pacific role. Aseta Redican got it. Instead, I got the locality project manager for the client relations and research team. role, and wow, that really blew me away, because I thought that was greater than the Pacific role. And actually the roles were on par, it was just my perception at the time. But I thanked God for that opportunity, and I thought, wow, I'm going to be in this job forever. I was barely a year into the role, and part of that role was going around, so that was the funder-provider split, going around with the Crown Health Enterprise, which is the provider arm, and the Regional Health Authority, the funder arm, which I was a part of. So the funder and provider, we'd go on road shows in the South Auckland District.
Yes.
And I went around with Ingrid Thomas, who was the group manager of mental health for South Auckland Crown Health Enterprise. Also came across, his name escapes me now, but an American from California, a doctor, pediatrician, Jim. I can't remember his other name now. after that time, Ingrid tapped me on the shoulder and said, we've got these roles at the Crown Health Enterprise, patient care coordinator roles, they're quality and risk management roles, mainstream. And she said, I want you to apply. So there were four positions.
Right.
They needed four patient care coordinators. And long story short, I ended up taking one of the roles. There was a Māori person who took one of the roles in Tūpākehā. So my responsibility was child and women's health. So I ended up with the group manager from California. And 3 months into that role, they restructured. And I was like, what the heck? So we went from four people to two. So ended up with myself and the Māori manager being in that role. Almost a year later, it was just me taking on all four areas of responsibility. Yeah, so quality and risk management. So that was policies, incidences, accidents, complaints, medical misadventures. So these are things that I had never done in my life before, but I learnt from the people around me. And, you know, it was in the days of the Health and Disability Commissioner, that just coming into the infancy. But my experience in former roles in the cervical screening area around the Cartwright Report, you know, all of that gave me what I needed to undertake a role I'd never undertaken before in quality and risk management. So I did that for a little while, and then after a couple of years I begged them to make me redundant, because, you know, there was one person doing a huge job.
Load, eh?
Yep.
Massive load.
And they kindly did.
Yeah.
Gave me redundancy, and so I ended up then becoming a youth services manager. And I really thought, my kids used to say to me, Mum, you're not really cut out for working with young people. But of course it wasn't working with young people directly. I was the manager.
Yes.
So I was responsible for staff who worked directly with young people. So after that, I did that for a short while, thinking I was going to do it for a long while. And then I ended up, Aseta was working in the DHB at the time, and she encouraged me to apply for a role, establishing the Pacific Family Support Unit at Starship. Long story short, I got the role. You know, God is so good. He's got his eye over my life, because these are things that I never thought about doing, but people always tapped me on the shoulder and said, you can do this. So I did as I was told and applied, and, you know, the history speaks for itself.
Yes.
So I was at Starship for a little while, and it was there that I got the opportunity to do my MBA. And then, you know, we had Pacific Health Leadership Scholarships in those days. And I was really, really blessed to just be in the right place at the right time with the right people always watching over me. So I did my MBA, established the Pacific Family Support Unit. And then as I was coming towards the end of my MBA, another opportunity arose to become Clinical Trials Operations Manager for the for registering, piloting and registering the vaccine for meningococcal B. So that was in the early 2000s, and I'm like, wow, you know, like how is it possible for me to do this? But again, there were always people around me who mentored me. Like, it was no accident that I was shoulder tapped to do that. People knew I'd just finished my MBA. We were making sure, you know, people like Colin Tawe Tonga, Debbie Sorensen, Maura Duthit, and others, they had their eye on me and kept channeling me into the right direction. So, you know, you talked before about what I've done for you and others. It's only because of what other people have done for me. You know, you give back what you get and vice versa. So, it was thanks to those people that my name was put up. I was put through a number of interviews and I ended up doing that role. That was for a couple of years. And then as that came to an end, I thought, well, what am I going to do now? I've never looked for a job. It's always found me. So then Francis Agnew tapped me on the shoulder and said, what are you going to do next? And I said, well, I don't know. And he said, the Alcohol Advisory Council is looking for a manager. Tina, at the time, our Fijian Tina, was leaving the role. And so that was the first role that I was taking on that someone had done before me. So I wasn't sure if I'd get it. I mean, here I am in Auckland, never been out of Auckland. Yes. And I applied for this job, which was based in Wellington. But because of a lot of things that were happening in my professional and my personal life, I wasn't a drinker. And I ended up applying for this role. Yes. And I actually got it, which surprised me. And the role was about working with our Pacific people. And engaging them in a conversation around not taking on risky drinking. And that was quite a challenge for me because I didn't drink. So unlike most people, when I joined the Alcohol Advisory Council, I actually started drinking so that I would know what I was talking about. Because I don't want people to say to me, well, what would you know? You've never drunk in your life. So how dare you come and try and tell us not to drink or binge drink.
How was that experience?
I kept asking my mates, can you please put me in a room somewhere and make me drink till I'm crazy out of my head so that I can say to people, yes, I've been there, I know what it is to be drunk. And it never happened. You know, they would just laugh at me and say, you don't have to do that. And look, so the best that I got to was I would drink at a public event one glass so that people knew it was possible to just have one glass and not go silly.
And not make a fool out of yourself.
Yes. So I was making a point and thank God the point was made. And so, that's how it's not necessarily a way that I would encourage other people to get credibility in that space, but it worked for me. I've gone back to, I don't drink. I don't feel like I have to, set an example to people in that way because I'm not in that role. But at the same time, it was a good experience for me.
Yes.
Because I started to understand the challenges that people have because I could have got quite drunk.
Yes.
I could have gone overboard. But
you had self-control.
Yeah, because I had the right people around me, I had the right information, but I was able to also act on that information because it was in the right environment with the right support around me. And so I knew that I could talk to our people about those things that could support them in living by the decisions that they made about not drinking to excess. So it's not, we used to say it's not the drinking, it's how you're drinking. So it's not the alcohol itself, but that you drink to excess is what the real issue is, when you can't stop.
Absolutely.
And so it's alcohol. You can apply those same principles to drugs or food.
Food
is just another drug.
Self-control?
It's self-control, but it's also being in the right environment, being around other people who will help you to stand tall and be true to yourself.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so where have we got to?
How long were you in that role for, alcohol advisory?
So I was actually in that role for 8 years. Wow. Before... then the organisation was disestablished by the government of the day and transformed into the Health Promotion Agency in 2012. So the Health Promotion Agency was a combination of the Health Sponsorship Council and the Alcohol Advisory Council. And, you know, I thought, oh, maybe it's time for me to move on. And a lot of my colleagues from the Alcohol Advisory Council did move on, but I really wanted to give it a go. So from 2012 to 2014, I gave it a really good go. Unfortunately, in that time, my dad died. And, you know, at the time, I didn't realise it, but my dad dying in 2013 was a major, major setback in my life and in my career because I quite unconsciously started to realise that I went from being a workaholic who just, I could be at work 24/7, it wouldn't be like work to me, to I couldn't get up in the morning. I was like, what is happening with me? I couldn't get dressed. I really didn't know what was happening. I was having arguments at work with, and I always felt like I could get on with everybody, but things were not working well in the workplace. And so after some months of taking quite a lot of time off, I never take sick leave, but I took practically all the sick leave I was owed, and some mental health leave, long service leave, and a combination of all of that helped me to come to the realisation that actually it was time to do something different. And so the organisation was really good and, you know, gave me a good send-off. And then for just over a year, I actually didn't work at all. Yes. So I experienced what I can now call depression.
Absolutely.
I didn't know what it was at the time. I wouldn't acknowledge any of that kind of talk. But looking back now, man, I was pretty lucky to, yes, to come back from that to what I now call a phoenix rising from the ashes. From not working, I ended up going back to clinical. So I trained as a nurse. I'd done my MBA in the early 2000s. And then I thought, well, I didn't feel like I'd go back to management. I just had, had enough of bureaucracy because of what I'd experienced. And then,
yes,
I thought, let me get back to clinical. But to do that, I had to do my practicing certificate. And to get my practicing certificate, I had to organise a course at MIT, find my own placement, which I did. And MIT were very kind. They allowed me to find my own placement, or they encouraged me to find my own placement, but they also allowed me to do the course. Because I'd been a chair of their advisory group for some time, they waived the fees, which was $5,000.
Amazing.
That is significant. And so I was able to do that course, get past it in a couple of months, and I got my qualification. But then, you know, there's always hurdles to jump through. And even though I'd got my practicing certificate resumed, I then found that, okay, I didn't have the current clinical experience. You needed 2 years current clinical experience for anyone to take you on. And I thought, well, how are you ever supposed to get that experience if people don't take a risk and take you on, having recently got my... And, you know, even though I didn't have my practicing certificate, I never felt like I'd been out of health. In all that time that I hadn't had a practicing certificate, because I'd been around health and in health and, you know, okay, at a managerial level, but I didn't, and looking after my family, I didn't ever feel like I'd left the profession of nursing because I was always around making decisions for my family. Whenever my parents went to hospital, I was there right with them, looking after them, staying with them, because I knew what I knew. I had a kind of mistrust of the system.
Absolutely.
So I'd always rally my family around and say, look, 24-hour care for our people. We know their lives. People in hospital, you know, they've got other things. It's very easy to make mistakes if you're not focused and concentrated. So, yeah.
Absolutely.
Look, I have had a really long life, and I've probably gone on and spoken too much about it.
Auntie, can I ask you one question?
Sure.
You know, you touched on how you were out of work for over a year.
Mm.
Can I ask you, what was the... Were you able to deal with the mental health challenges you had at that time? Mm. Were you able to get to the root cause of it? Was it the fact that you lost your father?
Yeah.
That was the root cause?
Definitely on reflection. It took me a long time to come to terms with that. You know, the trigger was things weren't going well at work, and so I eventually left work. But when I had stopped working and I got right back to ground zero, no money, no income, from having lots of money and lots of, you know, like I never wanted for anything to, oh my God, I want for everything. I was in huge need. I had no money to put gas in my car, to fly anywhere. And yet it was interesting, during that period, I actually flew more than, with no money than I, and by choice, than I had when I had money. And, you know, I flew because of work and things like that.
Yes.
But I actually had the opportunity for, like, you know, people would pay my fare to go. For my birthday, somebody paid my fee to go home to the Cook Islands and,
amazing,
you know, sort of get back to myself. And there was always money, but somebody else provided. So I really had to learn to rely on others. Yes. And I realized that it was to do with my father, because obviously I went to the AP and had a real look at what the heck was going on in my life. But the comeback, I never booked into mental health services.
Yes.
I'm quite proud, for better or worse, and so I would never admit that I had any psychological issues or anything, so, which is probably to my detriment, I think. But I had enough help, and then one day, you know, I have a younger sister, and I've never really told her this, but to her credit, she kind of pushed me and pushed me to the limit where I started to realize, man, if I don't stand up for myself, my siblings are going to walk all over me.
Yes.
And this one in particular. So, you know, in life, I also want to say you have your supporters and your knockers. Yes. Your knockers are just as important for your getting ahead in life as your supporters. So it's not just the people who support you. They're important. They're so important. But the ones who knock you, who say, you can't do this, you can't ever do this, or, you know, don't worry, I'm going to look after you, they are just as critical to your development as those who support you.
Absolutely.
Because when they say that and you think, oh my God, I really am in trouble if this person is saying to me, I'll look after you, I'm really scraping the bottom of the barrel. But also when they say to you, you can't do it, you can't come back, you can't be who you once were. For me, that was a real motivator. When someone says to me, I can't do something, I go, okay, watch me. But I really needed that to come back from where I was in that place of depression. And yeah, just so slowly, bit by bit, inch by inch, claw by claw, I feel like I have sort of risen from the ashes as I've got confidence in, you know, reflecting on my life and thinking, oh, well, actually, who are you? You are a child of God. You know, these are your parents. Your parents had nothing, and you know, they gave you everything to become who you are. And, you know, this is the way you pay them back. And so, yeah, I started to get back to who I know myself to be. Thanks to my younger sister, who sort of kept poking me in all the right places. And so I'm really grateful to her. Because she's helped me to remember who I am and to get back to being the skilled, talented, qualified person that I am. But not just that, you know, like I'm a mother, I'm a grandmother, I'm a sister, I'm all these roles in society. And I think it's really important when you have all of these different roles that you remember, you come back to the core of who are you? Who are you and what is it that you want to be in life? And so I get back to, I'm a child of God. I'm the child of my parents. I'm a gift to my parents. And so my gift to God and my parents is to become the best that I can be. But and with that, you know, it's being humble about that. So in humility, but not humiliation. Because for some time I used to think that I had to humiliate myself. But it's not that at all. Humility is not humiliation. So being humble is not a humiliation. So that's really critical to get that in your life. You don't have to put yourself down so that others can be lifted up. And I see that in a lot of our Christian upbringing sometimes. I think that we get the wrong impression that we have to be that. You know, I don't think God wants us to be humiliated. We don't need to self-humiliate ourselves or allow others to humiliate us to stand tall and strong and to shine as his children.
Absolutely. Wow. You know, Auntie Metor, it's really inspiring what you've shared. And I guess only those that have been through that particular experience, you know, going through dark times, you know, losing something that you love so much and didn't realize that people can comprehend or feel, you know, what one's been through. And man, it's really inspiring what you just shared there.
Thank you.
And I've just didn't realize you know, what you've just shared, how much you've been through. And you know, it just inspires me too that with all the experience you shared prior to that, you know, like you were molded into these roles and it's really brought out the leader in you and the person you are now. But also, you can be, or you are someone that can help others who are going through similar situations to rise above, you know?
Mm.
And that's something I feel strongly about.
Yeah.
But look at that. 10 more minutes, time flies, and I have to get you back in next week if you've got some time. Otherwise, we can pre-record. But I have to ask you, we've got to jump right ahead to right here, right now.
Yeah.
Would you like to touch briefly on that health conference you had back in quite recently, back in Niue, and your new role as well at...
So I've just come back from the Pacific Medical Association conference in Niue. So yes, the Rock of Polynesia. I think it's the 24th Pacific Medical Association conference. And it was amazing. The Rising Tides was the title of the conference.
Yes.
So the key focuses were on climate change and NCDs. You know, we've got this ongoing battle with NCDs. I'm not going to speak on climate change. That's not my area of expertise or comfort. But I do want to kind of touch on NCDs. So non-communicable diseases. So these are the things that we can do something about. They're preventable. Infectious diseases are not necessarily preventable. We can do things to try and not get infected. But non-communicable diseases like obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease are absolutely preventable. And so we have this, it's a global epidemic, so it's not just
Pacific.
It is a global phenomenon. But the thing about that is, in the global context, unfortunately, we feature quite highly. And I think, if I remember rightly, Cook Islanders, if not Pacific, are third highest in the world. That's disgusting. Because, you know, these are diseases of luxury, of opulence, of...
overindulgence.
Yes, overindulgence of people who have too much. Mm-hmm. You know, and like I said before, there's alcohol and drugs, but food is equally a drug.
Absolutely.
And equally something that we mustn't let dominate us. At the conference, one of the things they said is, we say we eat to live, but actually what we're doing is we're eating to die. We're eating ourselves to death. You know, we can do something about this. This is the message I want to get home.
Yes.
The non-communicable diseases is definitely in our sphere of responsibility. We can do something about it. And I mean, we individually, we collectively can do something about it. We're the only ones who can. The government actually can't, you know, with all the resources they throw at us, they can't make the change happen. They've got a responsibility in that, you know, in terms of making sure that the right environment is there to support us to make the right decisions. But ultimately, at the end of the day, you're the one who puts food in your mouth. You're the one who prepares food for your family. So, you know, I'm saying to all of those who prepare food, who buy the food, who prepare food for your families, you are the guardians of NCDs for now and in the future of our families. One of the programs that we've got at Alliance Health Plus, which I presented on at the conference, is Positive Parenting Active Lifestyles, which is a lifestyle weight management program for under fives.
Yes.
So at the before school checks at 4 years of age, when we identify a child who has a BMI, body mass index, in the 91st centile, it was the 98th, now we're going lower in the 91st centile, and it's 2 years, 3 years, or 4 years of age.
Yes.
We are now working with those families through a contract that we have with ADHB to say, let's have a look at your lifestyle. Let's have a look at your nutrition, physical activity, your sleep habits, the behavior of your children, and let's look at what you have the responsibility and power to do to make changes in your family for your child. The child is the trigger.
Absolutely.
And what happens in this program, it's a 14-week program, what happens is, as you're going through the 14 weeks, parents start to make changes that impact on not just that child, but actually the whole family. And so in 14 weeks, families can turn their lives around to one where that child was destined to become a diabetic, to be obese, to have cardiovascular disease. And so, you know, the thing is to go right back to the beginning. When we try and deal with it at an adult age, it's kind of too late. It's not impossible, but it's almost too late. And so when we focus on our children, make sure that our children are given the right nutrition, physical activity, the right environment, plenty of sleep, you know, like don't expose them, don't let them have too much time with all these gadgets and technology.
Absolutely.
They have a place, but we need to structure and schedule our lives if we want a particular outcome.
And it's almost like taking the proper holistic approach, focused on the young ones, eh?
Yep. Because there's also the spiritual element in all of that, physical, mental, social, spiritual. You know, we've always said we need a holistic approach to life. Well, let's not just say it, let's do it.
That's amazing.
So the other thing I wanted to say about the conference, actually, is there were 10 psychiatrists for the very first time. Dr. Itawini Ma'u, Francis Agnew was facilitating, Dr. Russell Blakelock.
No Alo there, eh?
No, unfortunately Alo didn't make it. I hope he's at the next one. But it was, you know, that's pretty groundbreaking and rare to have 10 psychiatrists on the Rock of Polynesia.
Amazing.
Let alone in the PMA conference. So one of them, Chris Seale, is a psychiatrist in training.
Yes.
So, man, these guys shared their stories and they're amazing. So Chris started off as a healthcare assistant. His mum worked in old people's home. He worked in the kitchen, then became a healthcare assistant, and then started life as a nurse, completed his nursing training, and then took up medicine. And then as he completed his medicine, he ended up becoming a psychiatric registrar in training, where he's at right now. Very inspirational, this young Samoan boy. Another Dr. Russell Blakelock, who I've worked with in theatre as a paediatric surgeon. You know, Russell Blakelock always stood out to me as some amazing young man who was rare in his cohort of people. But what Russell shared with us is he had what he called imposter syndrome. He always felt like, whoa, what did I do to deserve being here? Like, here's this guy, he's an accomplished surgeon and consultant, and he's going, what did I do to deserve here? You know, one day I'm going to wake up and somebody's going to find out that I'm an imposter. I'm not who I say I am. Anyway, Russell's been through quite a journey in his lifetime, but he's gone from being a pediatric surgeon to he's now a consultant psychiatrist. So he's got two particular specialties under his wing, but more than that, the personal journey that he's gone through in his life to mould him and to make him who he was. You know, like he shared that he had self-esteem issues. And like for those of us who are quietly experiencing these things, that's quite something to hear an accomplished surgeon, consultant, psychiatrist say about what was going on in his head.
And he should surround himself around people like you and Lita Foliaki and your
team. Well, he actually talked about Kiki Mawate and people who said to him, don't listen to those voices. Don't listen to people who say you're not really Pacific, you know, because he's got a Fijian, Samoan, a mixed Pacific heritage, and didn't speak the language of any of those, and always felt like he was a bit of a fraud. And Kiki and others would say to him, ugh, don't listen to people who say that. And I say that to people out there as well, is don't listen to people who do say to you, oh, you're not really Pacific because you're not this and you're not that, or you're not really whatever. Because as Russell quite rightly pointed out in his vulnerable story, is that's all rubbish. You are who you choose to be.
Absolutely.
And so when he started listening to Kiki and others, look at where he's got to in his life. He's like physically half the person he used to be. Like he's lost heaps of weight.
Walking that talk, eh?
He no longer has self-esteem issues and he's walking the talk. And you know, the conference had so many stories of inspiration. There were lots of PhD candidates. I'm so proud of our young people who are coming through from Australia, from Queensland, from... PMA, I think people should... the next PMA is in the Gold Coast in October next year. plan now to be there, because when we go there, we share and we network, we affirm who we are as Pacific people, standing in the greatness of who we are.
Absolutely. Auntie Metal, I'm going to have to get you in here next week to finish off our Talanoa. It's been a huge blessing having you here, and you're always an inspiration around us, you know, and may God continue to bless you with many, many more.
Thank you.
Years thank you, working in Pacific Health and health in general.
Thank you.
May God bless you.
Okay.